As it often is with people who have made some sort of creative work, I met John Romero twice. I first met him because of his work with computer programs and the seminal work, Doom, which somehow fell into my life from my friends, and I was told, you have to check this out. And like a lot of other people in the early 1990s, I booted up this program, and I was transported to a bizarre, otherworldly experience. And I walked through the hallways and the rooms that John Romero helped create. And then many years later, I met John Romero the person while shooting my documentary about text adventures. Each of those represents important parts of my life, and John Romero, both as a celebrity figure and as a person, is worth knowing more about, and so I'd like to tell you about him. This is Jason Scott. You're listening to the Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It podcast, a podcast about technology, stories, history, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to Jeff Atwood, Dan Boyd, and the hundreds of other supporters who are helping me get out of debt by contributing to Patreon, PayPal, and so many other methods through my site, podcast.textfiles.com. I met John Romero's work long before I met John Romero. Doom, when it came out, was a truly groundbreaking work. You can certainly find many other programs before it that had aspects of what Doom did. There's maze games and first-person games of all sorts. But the combination of the work by all of these people at id Software fell into the general zeitgeist in a way that programs hadn't before. Doom, you see, was not just the program. It was also a way of interacting both with a game and with your friends via networked connections. So after you went through the bizarre, unusual, occult experience of Doom, and you beat it, there were endless games to be played against your friends through all sorts of deathmatch levels, and you would actually move your computer to other homes or centralized locations like gymnasiums or community centers to play Doom against each other. Doom was the program that lets you get closer to your friends and coworkers after work had closed. You'd hijack the work computers, you'd turn down the fluorescent lights so nobody saw that the office was on, and then all of you would play each other and take each other out, and the next morning you'd share bleary-eyed glances knowing exactly how much fun you had had last night and where the leadership roster was. Doom became a hobby, a sport, and a palpable, real feeling of having been somewhere and gone against other people and enemies and vanquished them. It is a architectural marvel. To understand the technical aspects of Doom, well, that's more than this podcast is going to do, but boy, are you in luck if you haven't before, because they have ported it to every platform known to the human species and perhaps to alien ones, and they figured out the genius that just keeps paying off in what made Doom so great. You see this in a lot of other software programs that made a difference, like Ultima or Pac-Man or Katamari Damacy, where going into the code betrays not just the simple algorithms that made things happen, but the decisions that came from the blood and the sweat and the time of wanting to do what you're doing to its top quality to ensure both longevity and happiness in interacting with this program forever. Doom had this. Doom had this in spades. If you were able to enjoy a first-person shooter when it first came out, it changed your relationship to computers. It changed your relationship to everyone. And John Romero was a very big part of that. By the time Doom comes out, John is a hardened veteran of creating programs on computers. He'd been doing it since the early 80s. He had been doing journeyman work for places like SoftDisk and Infocom. He'd worked on all sorts of little programs, big programs, and he had developed a love of what made these computers so fun and capable of such deep experiences when sharing it with others. There's a wonderful video out there that I wish people did with more programs, where John Romero plays one of the levels he designed in Doom. And besides the fact that he is playing it pretty expertly while he's talking, he functions as a tour guide who walks through these different rooms and describes his thinking and the placement of doors and windows and how to make the player go in one area and not look in another. And while he's doing this, he's just randomly dispatching monsters. And I wish that more people had created their own running thoughts about what put them in one particular mindset when creating the architecture of their video game spaces. In fact, looking for the name John Romero now provides all sorts of recordings and podcasts and interviews where he talks through what made him take certain decisions. So if you're curious about John Romero's thinking or history, there are jewels scattered among the beach of the internet for you to scoop up and enjoy. This person, this giant, life had made him into a mythical figure, almost beyond reaching, a living legend of gaming. But not beyond reproach, with programs like Daikatana that had caused people to try to tear him down and say that his approach and his attitude were way too big for his britches, and to say that he wasn't everything that he said, and the constant contrarian mewings of people who had not really done much in this space and didn't understand what he was shooting for. Continuing his work, it's not easy to be in the games industry, and it's very hard to work at a top level of game creation and design for decades on end. It's just one of those industries that chews people up, spits them out. It's like movie making under a double boiler, because not only do you have all of the pressures of money and commercial interest, but you have a interactive audience that demands all sorts of unreasonable things from you and then continues to long after the so-called end date. I mean, try to imagine making a movie and then putting it out, and then you have to reshoot scenes from it for months or years afterwards, and people demand that you change the storyline or replace this actor with another or make the entire movie capable of running on a 4K television when it was shot for black and white 50 years before. It's just this bizarre other world the gaming industry is, and he has survived in it up to the present day. If it's not obvious, I am pro John Romero. I, in fact, can't believe there are people who are anti John Romero. But let me shift forward to the second time I met John Romero. What had happened was that GitLamp was in production, and I was kind of reaching out to various figures. I thought it would be interesting for people who were known for other seminal genres like first-person shooters to talk about the effect of text adventures in their lives. And I wrote to John Romero, and he wrote back immediately and said, "Of course, I would love to do this." And I thought that was amazing, and I made arrangements with him to meet him in San Francisco, where he had a new company called Slipgate. And the next time I was out there, it would be great to meet him. And he was very flexible in terms of scheduling. And again, this was a person whose name had floated in front of me for well over a decade at this point as somebody who was a living legend. And when I met him outside of his building, his first words to me were essentially, "Jason, it is such a pleasure to meet you." He took me in, and it was after hours. It was a Sunday, as I recall, and we shot in his offices of Gazillions, and they were working on some new projects, so he had to do it in his office because we had to aim the camera so that none of the other project assets were seen behind him, you know, no posters or charts or anything. I remember that in the shot, he has a boombox, and he explained to me that this boombox was the one that sat inside of the id offices when they were all in the same room and putting code together and testing things. And so he had, you know, filled his life with memories of where he had been while working on things now. I thought that was very admirable. His interview was wonderful. He answered all of my questions as fully as he could. He didn't let himself get down into some wool gathering of a tangent. His answers were clear. They were great to edit. And during this conversation, I found out he had done work for Infocom. He had created a minimized operating system for Infocom programs so that it wouldn't take up more disk space than it needed, and that would leave more for the games. He talked about having punch cards on the back of his bike and working on a program day in and day out. And then one day, his bike bounced and all the punch cards went everywhere. And that was the lost John Romero program. We talked for about an hour, I think, and he told me about his enjoyment of the BBS documentary and why he thought text adventures were amazing, and he wished me well on working on the new text adventure documentary and however that would come out. And when GitLamp was finished, he's in there just for a short time, but he mentioned how much of everything in his life came from being inspired by text adventures. A beautiful quote. We shook hands, and we went off our separate ways. For a lot of people that I've interviewed, that's usually it. They're busy. I'm busy. It was nice to talk to you about the old stuff. We'll move on. Occasionally, we might correspond, or I'd let them know that a project was out, but that's mostly about it. Not so with John. John was communicative. He asked me questions. He asked me to look things up. He offered me help when it was needed. He talked about things he was going on to do and if I could help in some way. Over the years, I'd meet John. He'd be at a convention or a grouping or a small meeting, and we would both have been invited or attend. And what I found was the incredible amount of energy and assistance he would give people who had all of the same basic questions, or who were interested in some very minor detail. You know, there's a line like, doesn't suffer fools gladly. John suffered fools gladly because he knew people aren't often fools. They just didn't pay as much attention to a subject as he did. And John has this memory for when things happened, when people were doing what and where that went and who did what and everything else. He's a living museum of the parts of the world that he touched, and that was very valuable to a documentary filmmaker, but it's been incredibly valuable to a historian. Speaking of which, John has been a gold standard for a person who is part of history working so hard to keep history around. I'm thinking of someone like Ricky Jay, who is an incredible magician, but has also worked so hard to preserve a lot of magic history. John's very similar. He's done history podcasts. He's asked people to give him artifacts and then transfer them over. He's an incredible advocate for the works of Nazir Gabelli, who is an Apple II 6502 programmer, who is a genius, and John has worked so hard to make sure his name is never forgotten. In the late 1990s, John invited a bunch of Apple II people to come to one location and have a party, and he called it the Apple II reunion. And there were all sorts of luminaries there, people who had done Apple II programs that were what made that computer such a fun machine to game on and program on. And when you read about all these different luminaries who had been in one place, I mean, everybody wanted to be at that and were so sad that they missed it. But I'm lucky. I got a second chance. John and his wife Brenda invited me to his second Apple II reunion, where he invited all the Apple II folks he could still reach before he and Brenda were selling the home they were in to move to Ireland. And they asked me to come along to set up a camera and get interviews. And I interviewed four or five people who were willing to sit. And all of those interviews ended up on the archive, edited and full of all sorts of lore that may or may not have come out if it wasn't for John wanting it to be saved. It was an honor and a pleasure to play that part. Okay. So let's stop for a moment. Yes, I do admit it. I'm a John Romero fanboy. And it's something that came about because beyond seeing his work, I got to see his life. I got to see the kind of love he shows for his family. I've talked with him about his values and what he cares about, and they're admirable. And I've seen how he treats people in a wide variety of situations and places. I have seen him interact with people for whom doom was the big shift in how they thought their lives would go and who became game makers because of it. And I have seen John interact with them as if he is personally blessed to have played a part in their lives. I've seen him fight people in death matches and utterly whip them and smile while he does it and talk with them afterwards. I've seen him get up on stage and really stress how important game history is and preserving what people have while himself being a part of it. There's a pattern there. There's a template there. It's something that I've tried to do with the work I do, try to reach out to folks who liked the BBS documentary and give them as much film advice as they can stand, to find people who like textfiles.com, who love talking about the Internet Archive, and never once cut them off as if they're bothering me. Never tell them that I already knew something, that they're just telling me for the 100th time something I knew. I want people to be able to have an audience with someone who influenced them and be able to walk away happier, better informed, and maybe, if I did it right, doubly inspired. So here's something that I picked up after studying John for so long. If you look at his biography, one attribute that I really find interesting is John's willingness to move physically, to go places when he finds that there's opportunity there. If you look at the history of id Software and you look at the places that they moved around, John would happily pick up stakes. He would move in with the other members of id. He would travel to Texas and California and New Hampshire and wherever he needed to be. He would never let physicality get between him and his dreams and his goals. The separation of John Romero and id Software is a complicated and strange one, but one of the factors that caused friction was definitely the fact that John became much more interested in the community that had come around id Software than grinding down into day after day of programming and iteration and testing. He recognized something, which was community management was the future of software. You could create a program that had mind-blowing graphics and an incredible engine, but if you didn't make sure that there was an audience out there and then made their voices heard and didn't respond to them quickly, your program was dead in the water. It was a tech demo that came in a box, and he saw that so further ahead than a lot of other people. And as I've seen him work in the years hence, people being the most critical component of the software, I think it's really paid off, and I think it's where the industry is. And finally, I think John Romero appreciates that he became John Romero for a whole variety of reasons, interactions, friendships, and pure luck. And he's never taken it for granted. He knows that Doom and Quake get him in the door, But he doesn't stand there and consider that the be-all, end-all of his life. To watch him continue to put his heart and soul into this thing that has always been part of his life, well, that's a cup I will drink from in all of the things I do. There's a game made by his son called Gunman Taco Truck, in which you are a Mexican taco truck owner driving through a apocalyptic world. And I got to watch John, with the pride of a father and collaborator, turn Gunman Taco Truck into the best it could be, the best experience, the most people knowing about it, and really making it into a fun summer camp experience of having this program out there and having it be part of the audience and talking about, you know, the implications of it and what was behind it and what his son wanted to do with it. You know, I got to see what he does for the next generation. If I can do something like that, that's a life well spent. This is Jason Scott. You've been listening to the Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It podcast. Thanks to James Bekoyanu, Sam Johnston, and the hundreds of other Patreon, PayPal, LibrePay, and Direct Up Shaking My Hand supporters who have helped make this podcast possible. It's the 20th episode of this podcast. That's crazy. There's people who are learning about it just now. I'm seeing folks stumble onto it, recommend it to others, and what they hope I'll talk about, and that's really exciting. I knew this would be fun, and a part of me has wanted to make some sort of podcast or oral history for a long time, but being able to do 20, that's a solid body of work now. That covers subjects of my life. There's things you've heard about that I never thought I was going to tell anybody. There are things about myself that I had to bring up and talk about and find their meaning and try to explain it to you. And that's been an incredible exercise for myself. And this podcast, I think, takes me out of my own head and will make me a better person. I got my bank statement this week, and for the first time in what feels like a very, very long time, it showed me the amount of deposits, the amount of money in my account, and the amount of money that went to different things, and all of them were healthy. And I'm going to share one more thing. And, I mean, this is really important to me. When I was living with my brother, I was paying him rent, but there were times I just couldn't make rent. I had all of these bills, and my brother is my brother, and he would let me skip a rent here and there because, you know, he's going to support me. And I know it hurt him. I know it got him warnings and bills and maybe even dings on his credit. So one of the things I've done recently is hand him a couple months' rent. Rent that I should have paid across the last 7 years. Owing money to the family is one of the most self-destructive things you can feel. And a little bit of that has gone away. And thank you so much for that.